everyone, and welcome to the second Charity Bombs podcast hosted by yours truly. Today we have a very special guest. She is both the founder and MD of the brand consultancy Brand By Me and is the powerhouse known as Colette Phillip. So welcome, Colette.
Hi everybody.
We're very, very, very excited to have you. I just want to say I was dying to speak to you after our first online conference. The way you chaired the group of, I think, 8 people so seamlessly, it was so engaging. I think everybody was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I didn't know Zoom could be so interesting. And I thought, if she can do that, then I need to speak to her. So if you haven't checked out our online conference, do check out on the website. But yes, so let's get this ball rolling. So Colette, please tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into comms and what was that journey like for you? And what inspired you to become a charity communicator?
Okay, so I started life in advertising, actually. I worked in big ad agencies for the first 8 years of my career. So my entry into the charity sector wasn't the nicest because I actually burnt myself out of advertising. So I had to take a bit of a break and then rethink sort of my career. But when I was on that break, I suddenly remembered, I'd forgotten about it or maybe pushed it down, the fact that I'd always wanted to work on a charity brand. And I was suddenly reminded of this when I saw an ad for a job at Barnardo's in The Guardian. Mm. And I was like, this job. It was called Senior Marketing Manager, and I was like, oh, I don't have any marketing experience, never mind, I've been in advertising. But then when I looked at the job description, I was like, oh no, this is, they're looking like for me. I mean, this just looks like me. This is like all my experience. It's me, this is my job. And so I applied and got that, and that was how I got into comms and how I got into the sector. And that's as simple as that. I knew I wanted to work on a charity brand. Realistically, I thought that would be within an ad agency. So I thought I'd get to work on a charity account. So when I saw the Barnardo's job, I suddenly was just reminded of this and just thought, yes, I have to do it. So that's how I got into it.
That's so cool. So as we mentioned previously, you do own and manage the Brand By Me agency. I think for a lot of people, especially in this climate, they're looking to diversify and see how they can start their own business or become a freelancer because, woo, Corona has messed everything up.
Wow, Corona. Over this time, really? I mean, I've had to revisit my decision about setting up a business, but I still love it, to be clear. But I have, it's not easy right now.
Could you give us some advice about starting an agency? What did that look like for you? What surprised you along the way? And what things did you take on from your experience in the corporate world?
So where it came from for me, I'd gone back and forward. So I'd done agency and worked on big FMCG type big brands like Starburst, Clearasil, Veet, McDonald's, like big, always big brands. I went to Barnardo's where I was for 4 years and built a brand for Barnardo's behind the name. And then I wanted to get, I guess, more brand strategy experience because I was assistant director of comms and a brand was a big part of what I did, but I learned it on the job. So I went to an animal charity, a global animal charity, and I'd done a rebrand, a global rebrand. And then I'd also worked alongside one other colleague and director on the organizational strategy. And I got to the end of that and I just thought, what next? And I actually wanted to, you know, go for kind of the next level of senior role, not just director of comms, but I wanted to go for that board level role in strategy or sort of a bigger marketing role. But I will be open about the fact that I hit a bit of a ceiling, honestly, and I wasn't sure. And so I took a career break again. I love my career breaks. And I took 3 months. I saved up money and I was going to have 3 months and I was traveling for a bit of it. About 3 weeks in, I literally woke up one night and was like, oh no, I need to set up my own agency. Oh, and it's going to be about brands that drive social change. And you know what? It's going to be for like medium-sized charities and it'll be called Brand By Me. And that's it. And that's what I did. So in terms of my advice, I think one, work out whether you want to run a business or freelance because they are different. And it's really important to understand the difference. If you're freelancing, you will be going into organizations kind of as a temporary employee quite often. Whereas if you're running a business, you are working with organizations as clients and in an objective sense. And although there's overlap, particularly if you're a sole trader, they are different and how you need to communicate who you are and what you're about is different too as a business or as a freelancer. They look different. So I think that's the first thing, be really clear which one it is. And it's not either or. They both can be brilliant. One suits one suits others. There's both an element of insecurity because, you know, it's not like your full-time permanent day job. Mm. So that's my first bit of advice. The second one is, no matter what, be super clear who you you are, what you stand for from the beginning, and how you're going to do and run your business in your way. It's about being clear on your purpose, understanding how your personality and the personality of the company you want to create, and really understanding your values and the values of the company you want, and using them to make every decision you make. The other thing is being really clear and specific on your audience. I read a stat where like something like 70% of small businesses fail because there's no audience for what they do. So it's really important to think about your audience and be quite specific, not within charities, that's too broad. I was like, medium-sized complex charities who work on causes that are slightly misunderstood. That was my audience for Brand By Me at the beginning, and that's my core audience. I'm being super specific on that. The other thing is, someone said this to me really early on, is like, enjoy the perks of being your own boss and running your own business. So all those kind of, oh well, I should do this, and they're telling me to do that, you need to stop that employee mindset, because actually running a business is tough. It's not easy, particularly now. It's not easy. You have to wear a number of hats, you have to focus on what you're good at, and there's going to be other areas where you're going to need to learn quickly. So the big thing you can do is make sure you're doing the stuff that you love and not compromising on that, and not going, oh well, I should do this, and the should letting all that. No, can't do any of that. You really need to be clear on, this is what I love and this is what I'm doing. And if possible, if I can't do that, if there's other stuff I don't so much love, either I need to learn to love it, or I need to outsource it to someone else in the long term. And that's really, and that's it about setting up a business.
Business 101 by Colette Phillip. There you go. Thank you very much. You actually touched upon my next question, which was with Corona. How have you been able to adapt in this season? And also, what are your long-term plans post-lockdown? How do you feel like Brand By Me will be able to ride this storm?
Okay, so whenever it was, March 20, whatever, overnight, like, the business sort of just disappeared. Our clients just stopped. Everyone was like, everything just stopped. We had some really exciting projects stopped, and it was just quite terrifying. So that was the first thing, and then you sort of, you can't just reel from that and sit there panicking. Also, there was this thing around, oh well, you need to pivot your business, but in reality, it's not easy just overnight to change fundamentally what you do and what you're about, and nor should you. What it is about, though, and what it was about for us, was finding out where people might need the skills and strengths and Brand By Me, you know, realistically, who has the money to pay for that, and then making sure in the meantime that we're managing and cutting costs wherever we can, our own internal costs, so that we can just survive the short-term sort of loss of income that we were experiencing. And that's what we did. And it, what it meant was, in reality, so I had a couple of clients come back and go, we committed to this big work. We don't have anywhere near that budget, but we've got this amount of budget. What can we do? And then we did something like that. And a lot of stuff was around personal brand, actually, which I'm still working on. So personal brand, meaning like you as an individual and what your brand is, and how personal brand comes out at work, and specifically how having a personal brand helps you if you are from an underrepresented community. Now, this was an area of work actually that I really wanted to do, and I sort of started being proactive in developing the business and going out to some companies to talk about that stuff. And obviously those budgets were cut, but people still wanted to do something. So we developed some like much tinier projects that we could do with those companies. Also started doing one-to-one personal brand work. So with, you know, leaders and people, kind of senior people within organizations, either they were self-funding it because people were furloughed and they were self-funding it because they had time, or, you know, their organization were kind of like, we've got hardly any personal development budget, but we can just do these small things. So that was a kind of just ticking over. I put myself on furlough for a while, and I mean, our team is actually primarily freelance. And so that meant that kind of timing sort of worked out from a cost point of view. And I guess the other thing was, and I guess this is my big learning, is it's easy when stuff is like a bit uncertain, is to just totally become invisible. But as a kind of small business, I couldn't afford to. So I was a little bit, let's say, proactive in wanting to be part of that conference, and actually spoke to the team at CharityComs around, you know, just opportunities. There's a lot going on for brands right now, and you know, what are we doing and what can we talk about? And that conference was one of facilitating that panel. When we talked about it, I don't think any of us knew how huge that was going to be. We did not know how huge that event was going to be and how awesome it was. Like, we so I mean good. I knew the event was awesome, but that was on another level. So that was really cool, and it sort of kick-started. It just did, it made me on a personal level just feel like it's me and doing Brand By Me, and even amongst the turbulence I can still be me. And then from there I kept being visible. So we did a YouTube, our YouTube channel is like youtube.com/brandbyme, And on there, we did a series, an 8-week series called How to Steer Your Brand Through Turbulent Times, which was just, you know, 15, 20 minutes with just quick tips every week, reflecting on what brands are doing, what brands need to be doing differently, and some key themes like how to stay visible, which is something we were experiencing, how to speak out, because even before Black Lives Matter, COVID-19 is affecting some communities quite badly. And from a brand point of view, there was a need for people to speak out and maybe counter some of the more dangerous messages that were happening around the impact of the virus. So, you know, how can you do that? How can you, you know, lead with purpose? So all that stuff. So we did that as well. And then, you know, honestly, the other bit of it was just spending time really building our network, really looking at our network as it is and looking at who's in our network, what do they need right now? And just connecting with people, which actually made it a really lovely time because I just ended up connecting with like minds across different networks I'm part of. And that gave me a number of opportunities that are now being realized just by connecting and going, what's happening for you? You know, in some ways, quite a lot of it was with Black women, honestly. And it's like, oh my, this COVID is awful if you're running a business, or it's awful, you know. But then, here's what we're doing. Oh, this might be an opportunity, not now, but, and it just led to some conversations that sort of, I guess, just kept us just going. You know, it might have been what one of my friends called the fingernail climb, which is a bit like hanging on by your fingernails to the side of a cliff where you're about to drop off. It did feel a little bit like that, but we were still in there and just keeping going. Also, I mean, very practically on a personal level, managing our expenditure as a household. So it's me, my husband, my dog. So that's quite easy. It's me, my husband, my dog. But we had to, because the business income wasn't there, so we had to look at that as well, but we were able to do that too. So, you know, that was kind of survival mode. Then over time, it wasn't like, you know, and I've said this to a lot of people, it's not like switching on the lights off and then on when it will suddenly be okay again. It's just been this gradual sort of evolution stroke movement through this, and we're not through it, but just through it. And using these things, staying visible, connecting, we're keeping connected to people, making sure we're super clear on the skills and strengths of Brand By Me. Not, you know, beyond brand strategy, as in brand strategy will lead, but how brand strategy can really help organizations at this time. And some of the stuff that sits within brand strategy that can really help organizations and how we can do that and being quite nimble about how we do that. And then just holding your nerve and hoping that your business survives. That's what it looks like. And so far it has. So well done us. Well,
yes, definitely deserves a clap though. Yeah. So you've spoken about harnessing insights and the power of brand to make a difference in the world. So what sparked your passion to keep pushing for positive change?
I think, I've always liked helping people. So when I was about 6, my brother asked me, and he was 4. He said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, prime minister. So I always wanted to help. Not because I like power. I thought about it and I remember it because I remember the conversation, and it's always one that's told at family things. I remember going, I want to help people, and I'm, you know, big sister, so I'm a bit, you know, I like to what effectively is lead. I don't, obviously, at age 6, I didn't say I like to lead, but I knew it was something in my head around that. Leadership and helping people. And then also, frankly, I was like, at the time, because I'm quite old, our Prime Minister was Margaret Thatcher, who is a white woman. And I thought, yeah, okay, good. Well, you know, woman, yes, but Black woman would be better. So that can be me, thanks. That'd be me. And I'm going to do that and help loads of people. And I think that's where it came from. I sort of went away from it in advertising, but not really. It was always somewhere there. And then when I joined Bernardo's, it set my head on fire, my heart on fire, because suddenly I was a little bit like, all this stuff I know about brand and this stuff around brands being able to, like, people, I so love brands, the impact that brands have on society, the impact that brands have in terms of helping people get stuff, making people think differently, changing people's habits. And this is just commercial brands. Fundamentally, when they launched iPad, right, everyone's like, what do you need that for? It's not a laptop. It's not a phone. What is this? Now, imagine life without iPad. Like, it created a new way of people. It created a need for itself. How awesome is it that a brand can do that? But it needs to be used in the right way. So actually, when you combine that with the need for positive and social change within society, you just have these fireworks and this magic. And when you combine that with a really powerful cause, it's just this amazing magic. So that, for me, it started with bringing together all the stuff that I'm great at with all the stuff I'm passionate about, and then some. And just the power of that, that's where that came from.
That's good advice for anything, honestly. Yeah. I feel very inspired. Thank you.
It's also, so a quick plug, we do personal brand work. It's all about that. What you love, what you're great at. and why the world needs it. That's it. That's what personal brand is all about.
Love it. No, I'm taking that away, definitely, from our chat. I really appreciate that. So my next question to you is, how can charity communicators ensure their work is true to their brand values? Or how can they develop their own brand values?
Yeah, I think it's also bigger than values. So I go, there's kind of four elements of brand. Your purpose, vision, personality, and values. And your brand is about how those things work together. And that's the same for organizations and individuals. So when it comes to us as charity communicators, it's fundamentally about doing maybe three things. One is understanding how our own purpose is linked to the purpose of our organization and the work that we do. So for me, you can see where it came to Bernardo's. I was like, I really, really love genuinely the power of brands and the impact they have. And this organization, there's something about this organization wanting to stand up, speak out, and reach the hardest to reach and vulnerable children in the UK. And I was like, where does that connect? And that for me connected in my role. Understanding that helped me motivate, it helped me be my best at work. It helps me for opportunities for myself and for the organization, both mutually beneficial things. So that's kind of the first one, is understand where your own purpose and the purpose of your organization connect. And the second one is, I talked about, use the strengths of your personality. So, you know, it's not about trying to fit in with what people think you should be, but really understanding your own personality and the strengths and what you're great at, and making sure that you're clear then about how that shows up in your role and in your discipline. So for comms, how does that make me an excellent communicator? These strengths of my personality. And then the final one is values, which for me are like kind of a superpower. Your organization should have values. There are a few organizations, I've worked at them, where they don't have managed or hadn't managed to articulate them in a way that was down paper, but they are there implicitly. Understanding kind of the values that your organization holds dear, but more importantly, your own values is super, super key, right? So you understand your own values and see your values. It's not everything you value. That's where you start. But then working out from within those, which ones are your non-negotiables? The ones that, okay, if someone paid me £1 million, still I wouldn't like move away from these values. The ones where if I had to, you know, if I'm doing something for free, this is where I am. These values have to be at play. It's that, the non-negotiables. And once you understand those non-negotiables, just use them in every decision you make within your career. That's it. Because actually, you know, when people go, oh, in my gut, it didn't feel right. That's your values talking to you. It's useful to have good gut feel. It's even better if you hone it and you go, it's my gut telling me that actually my value is honesty, and this organization, what I'm doing is maybe making me bend the truth quite a lot. That was the case for me in advertising. So that disconnect in your values, it's really important that you hone it and you understand where it's coming from. And that's why understanding your values becomes key.
You were preaching to me, I'm telling you. I was like, yeah, tick, 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 tick. It's so funny. I did this exercise on a course that was facilitated by Charity Comms, and I had to list my 8 values. And once you see on paper, it's like pretty much what you stand for. And you're like, okay, I can go forward and I can pick this job. I can take this opportunity. I can do this because it all makes sense. So when you were speaking, I was like, yeah, that's actually true. That's what I did afterwards.
I'm gonna build on that exercise and tell you 8 is too many. Cut it down and pick 4. Narrow it down to 4, because there'll only be about 3 or 4 that are non-negotiable. Some of them are then secondary and they're useful and good to have, but actually there'll be 3 or 4 really that are your really core motivators.
Okay, so I actually wanted to move on and ask you, how do social movements inform your work in the third sector? And I think this question will lead on to a lot of other questions I have for you, because we're in a time of, I can't even articulate it, but it's a time where lots of things are shifting and changing and for the better. So especially, how has that impacted your work?
This question is a really interesting one. I mean, God, because it was hard for me to answer, not because I don't know, it's because they influence everything. Because your brand is not just about, it's kind of who you are and what you stand for, but only as experienced through other people and how it shows up in the world. So I guess for us in our work, it's about if you can tap into, in a meaningful and compelling way, the strength of a movement and the strength of a feeling, and join in with that sort of collective movement. As brands, sometimes we lead the movement. At charity brands, sometimes we're just part of the movement, and we'll
flip. And sometimes we're just, you know, we're a core sort of collaborator within the movement. And all, understanding kind of all those roles and where we're playing is absolutely key. Understanding, you know, if we're part of the movement, how are we showing up in a way that is true to our brand, but fundamentally is supporting the movement. If we're leading a movement, what are we bringing? How are we bringing these people together to galvanize and spearheading it? Because sometimes it needs us to move to lead a movement, to drive change. And, you know, and making sure that actually, if we're leading that movement, that's not a forever state. That's just to galvanize and get people going. And we want that movement to break out and become shared. So what's the role of the brand within that? How are we using and like making this movement infectious? And what are we doing then to step our brand out of it so we make sure that the movement becomes bigger than us? I mean, there's big questions, but fundamentally, the growth of social movements is a massive opportunity when it comes to thinking about your brand. But it's not something, it's not a tool to be used or things to be manipulated. It is a meaningful way of you just being part of this wider change that you want to see. And fundamentally, it's also probably part of you really delivering on and achieving the vision your organization wants, because your organizational vision is going to be too big for you to do on your own. If you end up having, you know, a social movement that comes up and it's in line with the purpose and vision of your organizations, you consider yourself the luckiest organization in the world, because it will create a momentum and a pace of change that you couldn't have dreamed of. But then it's about how you operate within that movement, and you need to be really clear, humble, transparent about that. And so I guess that's for me, that's kind of how I see that in terms of brands and movements. It's inextricable. And it's something, you know what, this is an area for me that, you know, when I was back in the charity sector, this is something I had to learn, was the power of brand and movements. Because old-fashioned brand strategy tells you you need to lead, and it's about, you know, your brand is what people say about you when you're in the room, and but that doesn't apply, because actually your brand is much bigger than you. Old-fashioned brand would tell you you need to control your brand and make sure people use it properly. New brand goes, actually, you need to bring people into it and encourage them to play with it, use it, take it forth, and it become bigger than you. You know, this is the stuff. And that's where the shift in terms of understanding the power of movement and how you as a brand operate within it becomes really key.
Definitely. You always leave me speechless after your answers on that. Yeah. So, talking of social movements, we can't not talk about Black Lives Matter. And you recently spoke at Standing Shoulder to Shoulder for an incredible series of talks on everything from allyship to why using the word BAME as an umbrella is an issue. Regarding that specific topic, I actually saw an article written by Karen Blackett for BBC talking about how firms can diversify their workplace. Amongst that interview, which was really interesting, and she touched upon the term BAME being too broad a category to discuss a wide group of people, and basically it covered everybody that was non-white. And I wanted to ask you, do you think it's something that can be broken up, or do you think it's something that should be broken up? We should no longer talk about racism and police brutality in terms of every ethnic minority. Should it just be anti-blackness? What does that really mean, and how can we kind of dissect this, especially in the sector? Because I think diversity, equality, and that catchphrase likes to be used, and BAME likes to be used amongst everything.
Yeah, so I have I'm going to borrow actually from the way, because I heard this most well explained by our friends at Charity So White, who I love them. Some of them I would consider to be almost friends. I think one day we would be friends, some of the organisers. But in the meantime, I love their work and everything they do. And here's how, when we talked about it, here's how they said, there are shared experiences that exist across Black, Asian, and people from other minoritised ethnic backgrounds. I'm going to talk about minoritised versus minority as well, but I'll come on to that. And there are shared experiences. And actually, one of the things about breaking down racism is that you need to harness collective power. I guess where people are being marginalized, it's to make them feel like they're separate and small. And as individual groups, we might be quite small, but as a collective, we're big. So, you know, coming together as a group of BAME communities, full stop, is a useful thing for us to collect together, to understand shared experiences, but also to understand our individual experiences so we can represent and show up for fellow people of color. That's all very useful for us, right? That's very useful, harnessing the collective power of movements harnessing this. It is not useful when lazy people organization use BAME as the singular. Oh, we have a BAME person. What does that mean? One tick boxy BAME, but no, not this. So no, we're not doing that. Also, if you can't break it down, when you're thinking that BAME is all the same, no, not that either. So to be clear, and you know, whether or not you like the terminology, that's a personal choice. I use people of color when I'm talking about us collectively, and when I'm with my friends, and women of color when I'm with my friends. I don't say I'm woman of color, I'm black woman, believe me, blackity, blackity, black. And if I'm talking about, and two black people, I talk about black. And we have to, within the BAME, we need to talk about the individual experiences and issues and different, but we also need to, for us as communities, we need to understand and represent. That's where anti-blackness comes in within certain communities, because we have, people have seen it, I saw this as like the racism Olympics, where, oh, it's much worse for this group, or this, it's not Olympics. One group doesn't win at the expense of another. It hits one group, believe me, that's going to hit us all somehow. At some point, it might take a few years longer, but it will hit everybody. So actually, it's really important we see that collective, but it's not okay for organisation to use that as a one-size-fits-all, as a singular, as a just a homogenous group and see it in that way. No, organisations need to do the work and break it down. And that's really important. We collectively, as people of color, can come together, and it's useful for us to understand shared and individual experiences. But organizations should be breaking this down. So if they're saying we've got this stat in 4% BAME leadership, first of all, let's talk numbers. Secondly, let's talk about number of black people, because I can name those individuals of the leaders within that industry. When you've got 4%, that is a handful of people, right? That is individuals. That's not loads of people. I know, probably know most of them. But we've got to be real and not hide behind the percentage and a homogenous group and start breaking it down properly, because it will tell us where the issues are. And depending on what industry and where you are, there are different issues, and it will help you highlight actually where this is, so we can properly start to become sort of anti-racist and really tackle institutionalized systemic kind of racism. If we're still using BAME, percentage, nah, ain't gonna work. You don't even have a sense of the scale of the issue you're dealing with.
Definitely. It's interesting. So you joined our panel for the brand breakfast titled The Power of Many, where we discussed how brands can truly embrace diversity, inclusion, and equality. So this is another title that people like to brandish on different publications and events, etc. So you had a lot of amazing points that you touched on, but I'll only touch on about three. So I wanted to talk to you about what it means to work meaningfully and to be an anti-racist brand. And I wanted to basically ask, what did you mean by this? What does the work around this look like?
It's a very good question. And I think I'm still working out what I mean by that. So obviously, I guess there's been a shift between people's awakening, not us, obs. When I say us, I mean you and me as black women. It's not an awakening for us. But there's been an awakening in terms of people going, oh, I'm not racist. And it's like, not racist is not good enough. That means you're just not flinging around racist terms and things. You have to be actually anti-racism, which is about seeking out and standing up against racism in all its forms, visible, invisible, insidious. And I thought, as individuals, yes, but equally brands need to do that too. And I guess that's what it refers to. If you're being anti-racist as a brand, it's about looking for incidences where you are benefiting from systemic and institutionalized racism. It's about making sure that you do speak up where you're spotting it in your sectors, in your categories. And you're quite vocal about speaking up too. If you're spotting it in behavior of your followers or your supporters, you are calling it out and saying, no, no, not you. Please don't support us anymore. Thank you very much because of this. You know, you're being really clear. And also you're kind of looking in your own structures internally about how systems and processes might inadvertently be disadvantaging black people or broader people of color. And it's about at a brand level doing that work. So yes, we do it as individuals, but brands have a role to play too. So I'll give you an example of brands. There are any number of sports brands really benefit from black culture. They have, you know, black people that, you know, lead in their charge as spokespeople. Yet in their organizations, representation at a leadership level, non-existent. Yet in terms of, you know, where there are issues that are affecting black community, where are you in supporting and helping this? Or, and worse, actually, this is another thing in terms of anti-racism. It's not just about black people. So you're going, on one hand, we're very happy to showcase black people as being the standard for excellence in terms of athleticism. But I'm not going to ever have a hijabi woman come near my brand in terms of being visible. I'm talking specifically about Nike, who have changed that now. So actually going, actually, no, what are we doing? So That's an example of then actually where you need to move from kind of, well, we're not racist, we have black people, you know, as our spokespeople, to going, actually, no, we're anti-racist in our approach, because we're looking at all of these different kind of holistic way, from the communities we engage with, to the people that buy our products, to the people that represent our products, to the way that we are supporting the communities that we benefit from, and that we build our brands off the back of, and we're addressing all of these things and issues, consistently investing in it, not just getting bored, one token donation, then we're done, which is where Nike first started. It took them a while to do the hard work, and they got caught under fire. Because what's the first thing you do in Black Lives Matter? Do an ad. No, sorry, don't spend that money on an ad. Instead, go out there, let's look at your leadership, let's look at the work you're doing in communities. But that's an example, right, of what it takes. That's what anti-racism looks like at a brand level.
I agree. Everything says, I agree.
And probably more than that, actually. I was going to say, that's not an exhaustive list. That is now, off the top of my head, that's what I've done. When you delve into it, you'll find the definition of anti-racism is standing up against racism and rooting it out wherever we find it. And we look across every touch point, every audience of our brand, every opportunity for our brand. That's probably the bigger way of being anti-racist brand. The examples and sort of areas I've given are just starting points. There's probably way more. And as you do the deep work, you will find more, and you'll continue to find more, because that's how it works. So it's then about being committed to that long-term and investing in the long-term to really tackling this stuff.
Very true. So I also want to touch upon equality and equity. You said you're also an advocate for that. And I wanted to look at the work that maybe Brand By Me is doing with organizations around equity and equality and helping them to engage these concepts in their workplace.
So that's a really good and big question. So we are a small brand consultancy with 4 people. I'm a real advocate for equity, inclusion, and diversity in the workplace because of my lived experience, but not only that, because I just think it's the right thing to do. And I've always tried within my work and roles, you know, I had sort of director level roles, I guess, and looking at where I can make sure that I'm doing my best. So when I set up my business, it was like, okay, so where can we make sure? Where can we have impact? Not trying to take on new areas of work as EDI consultants. No, that's not where we are. It's kind of looking at the brand and what's the opportunity within the brand. And it typically looks like this. It looks like going, okay, this is our purpose. Is it inclusive, and is it tackling or furthering equity in some way, or is it working against it for an organization when we work with purpose? So if people work with us and they come to us and then we're looking at purpose and it seems exclusionary or elitist, we're going to question and challenge that. And normally in the work we won't, that's not purpose for us. The purpose is about why the world needs you. So that part of it is really understanding that and then going, okay, from there you need to live this and identifying maybe the areas where, you know, like you've said, your purpose is to, you know, end whatever, or everyone join together to do this. In reality, you're only serving these few people here. So actually, what there's a disconnect here, and calling that out, but not in a challenging way, bringing it to the surface so that together, working with our clients, we can look at how they might fix that. I said, when I look at the brand, we don't just do, people don't come to brief us and say, we just want to look at the brand values. We will look at the entire brand, purpose, personality, vision, and values. But often values is where you can put in and embed a commitment into a conclusion, a commitment to equity in your values. If it's not in there, it needs to be. And it can be in there explicitly as one of our values is equality, or it can be in there in terms of, you know, in the way that we do our work, expressing it in some way. So, you know, our value is community. That will equally mean that actually equality and inclusion to be a part of that. It will need to be. So you can use that. So it doesn't necessarily be everybody must have equity as their value, but actually in some of your other values, you'll see that it needs to, it's a core part of delivery of it. And then the other way, there are loads of other ways, but I guess it's about looking at, it through a brand lens, because that brand is what we do. Looking at that framework and going, okay, for purpose, personality, vision, values, and going, okay, how does that help us? The question, I said this to Zora, who led our, hosted our panel, is I said the question we asked at the Charity Comms panel was a brilliant one, because we said, what is the role of brands in helping us achieve an equal, just, and fair society? So it's not, what can brands do to drive D&I? Because that is, you know, that could be all, we're going to do some events around different cultural events. Okay, that's cool. But is it driving forward equal, just, fair society? No. If we ask that question, it elevates it. So, and I guess it's the same thing looking at your brand. What can your brand do? We all, as you know, charities. We believe in, you know, an equal, just and fair society. We have different ways into it. One, we might be focusing on animal welfare or on the rights of children or on, you know, whatever it looks like, the environment, whatever. We have ways in, but fundamentally that's our belief. So we can't just take that little issue as a lens. We have to look at our brand and look at how we can use it for societal benefit too. And I mean, that's a big question. It's not like we go, and that's the work of Brand By Me. Of course it isn't. We're a small consultancy. But what we do with our clients is make sure they understand their brand and how their brand feeds into that and how they can use their brand to help them on that journey. And the other thing on the flip side is, and I said, so we talk about positive business impact. So when we're working outside the sector, when we're working with corporates, quite often it's about going, how can we as a corporate business have a positive impact in the world? That's in our own workplace. So we do some work with underrepresented groups on personal brand. We also, you know, we're starting to, and this is where COVID really played a number with this, but we're starting to also talk to, connect up some of our corporate sort of clients with social change maker clients to do stuff together that's really going to drive change. Now, this is an incredibly exciting and new area for us, but again, it's through the power of brand. We're not like a partnerships agency. It's us spotting it. You seem to have shared purpose, or even you know, in one of our partners' case, you've got this corporate donor that they share a purpose. So you could be doing way more with that relationship. And let's look at the brand to see what that looks like. And let's look at the shared overlap in our purpose and work out what we could do in delivery of that together. It's that sort of stuff.
Yeah, collaboration is key. I think that's the main thing that's come out of COVID-19 and the sector, that we have to collaborate and have a collective voice in order to make real impact.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And lastly, you touched upon having lived experiences of racism both in the sector and the corporate world. So I wanted to talk about experiences of censorship and maybe not feeling like you can bring your whole self to work due to your race and the experiences that you had during your time, during your journey in general. So could you discuss that with us and what has that looked like?
So on a personal level, so I will say that it's something, yeah, I've got some horrendous stories actually from my time, but across the board. But and interestingly, I was talking yesterday to one of my old bosses, and you know, she was like, I had no idea that this happened when I was working in that organization. I said, oh, you know, because there was a sense you can't talk about it because it will be held against you. But I guess in that terms of being yourself, so I bumped up against this quite early on in my career. I started my career in a really positive sense. My first job in advertising was an agency called Grey, and my first boss was a black woman. Now in advertising, that is highly unusual. I was on a panel on Tuesday and someone said, I've never had like a boss that's a person of color, never had anyone more senior than me. And I was like, my first boss when I started in the industry in 2000 was a black woman, and a formidable, amazing woman called Sarah Jenkins, who's now the managing director of Saatchi & Saatchi. And she was my first boss. So I saw a black woman being herself with integrity and, you know, just this amazing personality. And I was like, cool, so I can do that then, because I've got a nice personality. I'm a great person. So I should be able to do that at work. That was my first 2.5 years. And really understanding by observing SJ how you can absolutely keep yourself, but you use your strengths at work, and also how you do the work to make sure that maybe some stuff where you've got your superpowers and your kryptonite, making sure you don't get the kryptonite affecting your superpowers, you know, it's that sort of thing. And then I changed agency, and that's where I suddenly was like, oh, it's not that simple, is it? Because as a black woman, people have stereotypes in their head, and even if you don't open your mouth, that's who they think you are. And so things like angry black woman, or you don't look like an account director, I was told once, that's awesome, cool, thanks for that. Or, you know, walking into a meeting and with another agency, and the agency guy walks right past me, shakes hands with my intern who's in a suit. I was also dressed smartly, but because obviously I'm a black woman, I can't possibly be the person leading the meeting, this sort of thing. So you sort of start to encounter that stuff, obviously while still having to do and highly perform within your job. But I guess the thing for me around being authentic self is, so my authentic, I've talked about it and you can hear it, I'm a very open, straightforward person, and integrity is the heart of what I do, to the point where I don't like to lie. I'm not very good at it, it's why. So I don't like to lie. So when, you know, you might go, sorry, a meeting run over. If I tell you, sorry, a meeting's run over, the meeting's run over. Otherwise, I'll be like, sorry, I'm running late, which is the truth. I'm running late. I don't explain why. That's just an example of it, right? I don't like to lie. I'm not going to pretend. I don't like it. So when I worked in advertising, I remember I'd moved account, and I was working on Always at the time and Always in P&G. And I loved Always. It's all about women and women's bodies and helping women understand their body. It was just an amazing brand to work on as a woman. I and my clients were also awesome because like three of the clients were men, but they really got it. It was just brilliant. And so we had this amazing relationship and I loved them and I was doing really well on the brand and they were really, really pleased. Like the clients were really pleased. So I had an appraisal. We have to ask both agency and client to feedback in our appraisal. So I had this appraisal and my clients all BCC'd me in with their feedback and it was all great. One of the more senior clients who I hadn't even asked for feedback, she actually proactively wrote in. She was like the general manager or something. She actually wrote in an email with feedback too. So the team told me we were doing this, so I've written you my feedback just proactively. It was awesome. Now I should have gone into my appraisal and got amazing feedback, probably a promotion, right? No. I went into my appraisal and I was told, yeah, you're doing a good job. There is this one thing though. Sometimes your clients have said that you're too honest for your own good. Now, I had my clients' feedback. No one once had mentioned that. In fact, quite the opposite. They said, we actually love the fact you're honest with us because it helps us manage our expectation. It helps. It means we've got a really good relationship. We can always trust you. This is the stuff they were saying. So obviously that just wasn't feedback. What it became obvious, and when I saw, I in my straightforward way, I went, oh, that's cool. Except I was BCC'd on that feedback. So which client have you spoken to? And maybe you've got confused. It's probably not one of my clients because I wasn't very happy about it. And at that time, I hadn't learned how to censor like my temper. So I wasn't happy, which is probably why I don't have a career in advertising anymore. Anyway, so I challenged it. And then it was like, oh, actually, it's the agency. Because in terms of account handling, it's not always good to be, you know, you just need to think about the agency's reputation when you're saying some of the things. And of course, when I'm being honest, it will be things like, okay, so we need more time because we want to get you the best creative. It'll be stuff like that. It's not like, this is all rubbish. It won't be. It'll just be the truth as opposed to, well, you know, we've got one that we could show you now. Or, you know, it's not that. I just didn't play the game. I was really open with my clients and they really appreciated it, but the agency didn't like it. So that's an example. So a very long-winded example of where there's a disconnect between who I am and my best self and what the agency wanted me to show. At the time, I ended up after a few years leaving that agency and I sort of allowed my light to be dimmed. But now I would do it differently because it's the same things happened. Oh, you know, you seem really angry. I'm sorry, I didn't even open my mouth and I'm not saying anything. How have I? Just because black woman. So I have learned now, though, that I need to be really clear on my values and I need to be clear on the strengths of my personality so that I signal it for people. So one of the things I do when I was working in-house in charities, I'd say, I am super passionate about brand, which means I'm really excited. So you're going to see that energy come across. And I'd introduce my personality so people got the strengths of it. So rather than tarring me with the stereotype, they saw me. I would say things like, okay, would you mind if I gave you a very, very honest perspective? I don't have to, I can, you know, but I'm going to give you a very, very honest perspective here. And then people, you know, they're not going to say no, can you lie to me? But then I've countered it. So when they then get, you know, the breathtaking honesty that follows at times, when I was working in-house, because sometimes you just need to say it how it is, when they heard that, they weren't shocked because they heard it. So I was able to do that. And it wasn't taking away from who I am. It was just signaling. So I learned to do things like this that really help. And now in our work as Brand By Me, that's the kind of thing when we work with personal brand, this is what we do. But it starts with the strengths of personality. I guess when it comes to, broadly speaking, people of color, we've done something which is called code switching. The example I know, I'm not the only one that's had this. You get feedback that, oh, to be a certain way, you need to do this, and it will be at odds of who you are. You know, I spoke to somebody in my network, and she said that for ages, she wouldn't wear her hijab at work. And actually, it was only when she had daughters that she said, actually, this is sending the wrong message to my daughters. So she started doing it again. But she was in environments where she felt that wasn't going to be okay. And that is a big deal, right? That's a big part of yourself to hide. And it's that. So it's it's not even being your best self. Okay, great. But actually, the workplace has taught us the opposite. So we have to unlearn that stuff. We need to rediscover who we are, and then we need to work out how we can be ourselves. It's a lot more complicated. But the good news is, there are people like Brand By Me to help you do that. So, but in all honesty, that's what, and you know, you just listen to this podcast, I've just told you how to do it. So that's it. It is as simple as that. Unlearn that code switching and don't do it anymore. Figure out your strengths and signal them. Demonstrate them consistently, because actually then you'll start getting the people coming to you because of who you are, not expecting you to be a different way.
Wow, that's some heavy stuff. Honestly, I'm like, oh gosh. It's a lot to take in, but it's good advice. I mean, I hope that this really speaks to people and the learning experience for a lot of people. But I also wanted to ask you, how are you practicing self-care? You mentioned when you were in the corporate world that you just got burnt out a lot of the time. Is this the same in the sector? And if so, how are you, you know, shutting the laptop, going for a walk, doing things that you love so that you can do what you love well.
It's something I had to really work on, honestly. I am not good. If there's something I'm not good at, it was self-care. From my time in advertising, but even when I hit the sector, and that was on me, not on organisation. Because I will say that, you know, charities are under-resourced and overstretched. There's always going to be too much work. So it is down to us to understand that. So I think there's a couple of things I learned how to do. The first one was understand, like, I've got a huge capacity, so I can do quite a lot, but I can't, you know, you shouldn't be doing that all the time. So if I'm constantly having to stay at the office till 8 or 9, I learned how to flag that with, you know, my line managers, my bosses, and then look at my work and go, actually, there's just too much work here for me to do in the working day. Now, I work in brand. So if we're in the middle of a brand campaign, I know that there's going to be a lot of hours. Also, when I've worked at global organizations, I know that in order to speak to the US, it might need to be an 8 o'clock call. But that's okay. It's not okay if I've started at 8 a.m. that morning. And if I'm doing that every week for several months, that's not okay. So it's first of all, being really clear and setting boundaries. So, you know, if I was having to do a late call, I would start late. And I worked in charities, quite a lot of charities have flexi time, so you are allowed to do that. And if they don't have flexi time, it's still highlighting that to your employer and saying, actually, my job is requiring to do this. Everybody knows you cannot burn the candle at both ends for a long time. There might be time where it's a super intense bit of work, but that should be time limited and finite. So the first thing was about setting those boundaries. The second thing is, these are mobile phones, right? Our mobile phones are like the worst. They are the worst. So because we do everything on them. So if you have a work phone, that goes away out of work time. That's it. Non-negotiable. I used to do stuff like, you know, I'd leave my work phone in my bag downstairs, and then I would go upstairs, or it's in my bag. Because some people, they, you know, unfortunately, we can't control others' behavior. And if you work in a global organization, you are going to be getting calls and emails 24/7. So if you've got your notifications going off the whole time, you are just not going to have any peace. I don't have on my phone, and I'm on my own business. I am, you know, this is it. I am managing director. I am lead business developer for this. Still, I don't have notifications turned on my phone, because I know that when I need to do my email and go in, I go in and do my email, and I know this. So that's the kind of thing. But it's not just about that, managing the work and managing capacity and flagging where it gets too much. There are emergency measures. Fundamentally, you also need to work out what gives you joy and brings you joy, and make sure you make the time for it. You know, those things where we say, go out for a walk, make sure that you're taking time out, step away, have your lunch away from the desk. They're all vital. They're just they're the basics of what we should be doing. It's much more. And if you don't know what the stuff that gives you joy, cultivate hobbies. So I realized this from coming from advertising, which is super intense, into quite a big charity role, into then other big roles. I realized I hadn't really got very much work-life balance. And also, you know, I was a single at the time, so I didn't really have anything except, you know, work. So I just started doing hobby. I remembered how much I liked dancing, you know, when I go out, when I did go out and that. But when we went out, I liked dancing. So I thought, oh, maybe I'll look at dancing. And I did. I found dance classes, but I found dance classes that were 1 minute walk from where I worked. So I knew that I could get there. I blocked it in my diary, dance class. So I would leave at 5:30 to get to my dance class. And I didn't pick the 8 o'clock dance class. I picked the 6 o'clock one to make sure I had to leave work. And actually, I found a reason to leave work. But I also created a hobby that I absolutely loved. I did Bollywood dancing for 5 years and I loved it. I just recently on Monday did my first dance class in about 3 years and I absolutely loved it. And I did it for ages and I got good. And it was something for me and outside of work that I could love and invest in. And it's important, and not just one thing, not just one dance class. It's important to have a number of things we do and understand what are those things that really nourish us and make sure that we're full up with that, and that we are making time for that appropriately. And now, even though I'm on my own business, and you know, it's hard because everything I do now, I mean, with an organization, I'm also going to say that, you know what, they are paying you for a certain amount of time of the day. You don't get any benefit if you work over and above, within reason. So if you're constantly overworking and stuff, you've got to question it. It's different for me now because I'm on my own business. Every hour I work comes back to me, the team, the business. So then it's quite hard to switch off, isn't it? Because it's sort of like, I could always work. But I still had to do it. So I said, you know, I did dance class on Monday. I walk my dog in the daytime. I will switch off to booking Zoom calls with my friends at 5:30. We've started doing this, booking in Zoom calls at 5:30, because it means we all finish work on time and then have our Zoom time together. You know, it's that sort of thing. And, you know, you can see how I've talked about habits and rituals, because you can't just say, I'm going to, you have to build it in. Book in the class, pay for it, this sort of thing. And that's really important.
Before we end, I have one last question. As this is the Inspiring Communicator series, I'd like to end this by asking you to share some advice advice with our listeners. I want you to motivate, inspire, and encourage them to be the best version of themselves. So I'm going to start off a sentence and I need you to finish it. So working for an agency in the charity sector feels like
getting to do what you're great at with really cool people for causes that make a difference.
Being seen as an inspiring communicator feels like
a responsibility, because the role of inspiring people is to bring people up so that we, you know, bring others up that are maybe struggling and want to be where we are.
And being part of the sector in general is
awesome and awful in equal measure at the same time, because there's such a big need and there's so many people that need help. It's awesome that we get to work in a sector that can help, but it's quite awful that sometimes the sector works against itself in doing that.
Love it. I've learned so much in this podcast. I feel like I should have paid for it, really. It's been very, very engaging, and yeah, it's been a great experience. So thank you for your final words. So thank you very much. That's it from us, and we'll see you next episode.